Okay, welcome to another episode of New Books in Terrorism and Organised Crime. I'm your host, Mark Locks, from Brisbane in Australia. And tonight we have the pleasure to talk to Guido Steinberg, who is in Berlin, about his new book, German Jihad, on the internationalization of Islamic terrorism. Hello, Guido. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Mark?
Very, very good. Very glad to be able to have this chance to talk to you. As I was saying in the pre-interview, you're the very first German we've had on the show, so I'm very happy to have this opportunity.
Great. Thank you very much. I thank you.
Yes. Now, as we normally do in these interviews, we'll start off with just a background about yourself. So what's your personal background, your study background, and how you ended up where you are in writing this book?
Well, I am currently working for a German think tank. It's called the German Institute for International and Security Affairs, or in German, Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik. That's why the abbreviation is SWP. I've been working here for 7 years. I'm an Islamicist by training, and I wrote my PhD thesis on the Saudi Arabian Wahhabia. Well, ever since 2001, I have been studying terrorism. I worked in the German Chancellor's office in the time of our Chancellor Gerhard Schröder for 4 years. And in all these years, I came to realize that the German jihadist scene is growing, not only in the country, but it is becoming more important internationally. Ever since 2006, we witness a growing number of young Germans of different backgrounds, of German origin, converts, Turkish origin, Kurdish, increasingly Afghans and others, going to Pakistan, joining terrorist organizations over there. And sometime in 2009, 2010, I decided that the time was ripe to write a book about it, because I had already written a book about jihadist terrorism in German, which is called The Near and the Far Enemy, in 2005, arguing that the basis of everything that is happening is events in countries like Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, and that many people discussing the problem did not really know about the origins, the local origins, the national origins of what was happening. And I think there has been a substantial internationalization process ever since 2001, and that the German scene is in a way paradigmatic, because if we go back to 2001, Al-Qaeda and large parts of the jihadist movement were still dominated by the Arabs. They were very much connected to local events in Arab countries, and that has changed. And I think by taking a look at the Germans, especially the Turks and Kurds, going to Turkey, joining organizations, Uzbek organizations, and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, there is a way to deeper analyze this internationalization process. So I do not only write about Germany, Germans, and Turks and the jihadist movement, but I write in a more theoretical way about the larger movement and the way it has taken ever since 2001.
Right. Yeah, well, one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is this other perspective. Obviously, I've read quite a few books doing these podcasts, and we're getting very much an English language perspective of the world. So the particular migration patterns to England, to the United States, to Australia, New Zealand, and Canada have not been reflected in Germany. You have a very different demographic makeup, which has led to this different perspective you're discussing, that Turkish background of most of the migrant population, well, certainly the Islamic migrant population, has led to a completely different response and a different career path, I suppose, for a number of the people who've been participating in jihad in Germany.
Yes. Well, yes, the Germans, in a way, are latecomers again, now the jihadists. I still remember vividly the discussions in the Chancellor's office in 2004, 2005. Whenever we had Americans coming over, they would argue that the lack of integration of European Muslims was a problem not only for the Europeans, but also for the US. And that happened after the attacks in Madrid in 2004, in London in 2005, and some smaller terrorist attacks. So the Americans were frightened that these European jihadists with European passports would find it easier to enter the U.S. and perpetrate attacks over there. Now, our reaction here in Germany, at least on the official side, was that this was, of course, wrong. Our argumentation was that the Iraq war was the very root of the terrorist threat, also here in Europe. And we argued that if the lack of integration was indeed a problem causing radicalization, then Germany would have to be at the forefront of this problem, simply because our Turks and Kurds are so badly integrated into German society. And in a way, I realized that this was premature in 2006 when we had the first evidence, when we found the first evidence that larger number of young Turks and Kurds and others were joining the jihadist movement. And in a way, this German jihadist movement has a very peculiar worldview, which is different from what I would call the Arab jihadist worldview, focusing on the Arab world, on Afghanistan, and so on. So the Germans, because Turks are so heavily represented among them, we have about 2.5 million people of Turkish origin here in the country. Because Turks are so heavily represented among our jihadists as well, they have adopted this Turkish jihadist worldview, taken a very close look at territories which have formerly been a part of the Ottoman Empire. So they are very much interested in events in the Balkans, especially Bosnia. They are very much interested in the Caucasus, and a little bit less in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that is what I have tried to do in the book, try to describe the physical voyages of these people via Turkey, either to Chechnya or then to Afghanistan and Pakistan, but also the ideological links, this, I would call it the Turkic jihadist worldview, which is a little bit different. And I think the most striking aspect of this worldview is that the war in the Caucasus, especially in Chechnya, is so especially important for all the German jihadists in the last 10 to 15 years.
That's right. It's a different process too of radicalization, I think, as well, because they've got the different cultural background, being Turkish rather than Arabic. You point out that often they're pushed to one side because of an Arabic prejudice amongst a lot of the overseas groups, especially in the training areas, I think.
Yes, this is what happened. But I think In the first years, the problem for many of these German jihadists was that they did not have any connection to the Arab-speaking jihadist world. I mean, I quote one of these guys in the book who says to one of his recruits here in Germany that he has to study Arabic because Arabic is the language of the Mujahideen. And if, as a young German, you wanted to join Al-Qaeda or the jihadist movement in Pakistan, in the tribal areas, in Afghanistan, you would have to know some Arabic, you would have to make contact to Arabs. And for many Germans, this is impossible because the German converts, normally they speak German, they might speak some English. The others, the Turks and the Kurds, normally don't speak Arabic. There has been a tendency to study Arabic, but that has remained the case. So in 2006, when the first the first German groups came to Pakistan in order to join the jihadist movement, they did not join Al-Qaeda, but they joined Uzbek organizations. In the beginning, the Islamic Jihad Union, later on, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. And I argue that the main reason is language. Because as a Turk, you can communicate, or as a Turkish speaker, you can communicate with Uzbeks. You can communicate with people from Azerbaijan. You simply have to play a little bit with language, and then you can join them. You can go through the training in their camp, and that was the moment when we in Germany had to realize that the attractiveness of jihadist thought was a lot stronger than we always thought. It was only that most of these young men and later on women had problems communicating with the jihadists. And now they had Turkic-speaking organizations, and this is when they traveled to Pakistan in droves. So the number in 2007, 2008, 2009 became a lot higher. Just to give you an example, in 2009 alone, nearly 40 Germans traveled to Pakistan and joined different jihadist organizations in the tribal areas. And this movement, it has a lot to do with language, especially Turkish.
Right, right. I want to get on soon to talk about the Sauerland group, if I pronounce that correctly.
Yeah, Sauerland,
right?
It's a soft S.
Oh, sorry, rather. But I think first it might be good if you can outline to us the normal path of radicalization and also point out that, as you just mentioned, some of the participants here are actually Germans who convert rather than simply from the Turkish migrant population.
Yes, yes. If I talk about Germans, I talk about sociological Germans. I don't really, and these are all those people who have spent most of their lives here in Germany, not withstanding their nationality. Many Turks who have been born here do not hold German nationality, but I consider them to be German. There is no single path of radicalization here in Germany. But if we try to establish some rules, it is obvious that there are certain Salafist centers all over Germany who have served as a recruitment ground. Most importantly, most famously, most infamously, the Al-Quds Mosque, where in Hamburg, where the 9/11 pilots prayed. But there have been other centers, and in the early phase, a place called the Multicultural House in Neu-Ulm in southern Germany was prominent. And in most of these centers, there have been single personalities who recruited, who at least drove these young people towards jihadist thought. These were normally not the official imams of these centers, but rather personalities who were known to everybody, who were affiliated to the center, but then took these young people with them to private homes and preached to them over there. So we have Neu-Ulm in the early phase, later on Hamburg, Bonn, also Berlin, where these people went to Salafist centers, then found someone who proposed to go to either to Pakistan or to training camps in other jihad theaters. The young men organized themselves afterwards. They went in small groups and then tried to link up to a certain organization. And the pioneers were indeed the Sauerland Four. These were two German converts and two ethnic Turks who went to Pakistan together in 2006. And it is striking that Pakistan was only a last choice. They originally wanted to go to Pakistan, to Chechnya, where one of their close friends had already died in 2002 or 2003, that was Thomas Hamza Fischer, but they did not manage to find a way because the recruitment networks in Turkey did not let them go to Chechnya, possibly because three of the four did not have any military experience at all. Then they decided that they might go to Iraq, went to Syria to study Arabic because they did not know Arabic at that time, at least not well enough to communicate with Al-Qaeda. And then, rather by chance, they found their way to Waziristan, to the Islamic Jihad Union. And in the coming years, when greater numbers of Germans went to Waziristan, it is striking that there were certain communities here in Germany that seem to have been connected to single organizations in Pakistan. So to give you an example, the jihadist scene from southern Frankfurt, Ulm and Neu-Ulm went to join the Islamic Jihad Union. people from Berlin first went to join the Islamic Jihad Union and then formed a new organization, the German Taliban Mujahideen. There were groups from Hamburg and from Bonn. They rather joined the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. And later on, and that is striking, later on when people had more experience, when they had already stayed for a while in Waziristan, many of them tried to join Al-Qaeda. So it seems as if the choice of Uzbek organizations was not their first choice, but it was rather because of practical questions. It might have been because of language, but in the end, their final aim was Al-Qaeda, showing to some extent how prominent Al-Qaeda still remains, although it sometimes seems to us that it has that it hardly exists anymore in Pakistan.
Right. What role did the internet play in recruitment or radicalization?
Well, it is very hard to say what the cause is. What we do see is a certain coincidence, of the growth of Turkish language and German language jihadist internet with the growth of the Salafist scene here in Germany and the growth of jihadist recruitment in the country. I do have the impression that the growth of the internet and the growth of German and Turkish language material is the cause for the jihadist recruitment, because we can see from about 2005-2006 that a growing amount of very important jihadist ideological material is translated into German. There is one author, Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, probably the most important jihadist theoretician of the last years, who has been translated ever since 2006. It was a movement which first started in Vienna, Austria, but then spread to Germany proper. And it seems as if this was the one jihadist thinker who was most revered among German jihadists in recent years. So the availability of ideological material, which until 2005 was exclusively available in Arabic, seems to have played an important role in the radicalization process. And to me, it seems as if it came before the travels of all these people. And today, it is very easy to get everything that you really want to read about the jihadist movement from inside the jihadist movement in translations. There are jihadist websites, there are forums which are focused on this kind of dissemination of jihadist thought in different languages.
Right. And were they, the people who were joining the groups, were they trying to target Europe? Were they trying to target America? So this question of the near and far enemy, what sort of role did that play in the German people who joined the terrorist organizations?
Well, it seems to me that there has been a change in recent years, namely that Germany has become an increasingly important target. And that there has been, in a way, a trend towards the formation of purely German jihadist groups. When the Sauerland Four, when they went to Pakistan, they later on contest in court in Düsseldorf. And I had the chance to talk to some of the suspects at that time, because I was there as an expert witness. And they very convincingly said that they did not really think about Germany. They wanted to leave Germany. They did not want to live here. And they wanted to fight the Americans in Afghanistan. And that is kind of a paradigm in the first years. The suspect, the jihadist suspects, they want to go to Afghanistan to fight. They do not care that much about the German presence in Afghanistan, but rather about the Americans. And even here in Germany, when the Sauerland cell came back, and when it is they wanted to attack American targets. They talked about Ramstein Air Base, the biggest American air base here in Europe. They talked about off-base facilities, but they always wanted to target Americans. And that has been a paradigm until today. Just look at the first successful jihadist attack here in Germany. That was the attack on Frankfurt Airport. It was on American soldiers. Two of them were killed. Two of them severely injured in March 2011. At the same time, with the growth of the German jihadist scene, there seems to be a refocusing among them. At first, we realized that some of these young guys who went to Pakistan then went to fight in Afghanistan, but they insisted on fighting the German presence in the north of the country in the Kunduz area. And that, in a way, was easy because the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan was intensifying its operations in the northeast of the country from 2008. But then we had this emergence of the first exclusively German jihadist group in the tribal areas, the German Taliban Mujahideen, in late 2009. And I think that was an indication that that there was something German emerging. The head of this group, that was Ahmed Manaf Basha, a Turk born here in Germany, was extremely anti-German. And because he was deported from Germany to Turkey in 2000, he seems to have developed an extreme hatred of the German state and German society. So ever since, there is talk in the jihadist scene about single personalities who want to build exclusively German outfits, who want to fight not only the German presence in Afghanistan, which will be terminated next year, but also the German state. And ever since 2011, we do see a growth of jihadist activity here in the country, but these efforts to perpetrate attacks have been foiled until now.
You start your book with, I believe, an excellent description of the whole concept of a near and a far enemy for the jihadists. So would you like to just give a summary and maybe explain why explain that they're actually concentrating more on this far enemy as the target rather than the near enemy?
Well, I think that is, of course, a new phenomenon. This debate about the far and the near enemy is perhaps the most important debate among jihadists for, I'd say, the last 20 years. And part of my introduction is drawn from my older German language book, The Near and the Far Enemy. And it is focusing on my view of the jihadist movement, especially of Al-Qaeda, in 2001. If at that time you looked at the organization from the point of view of, let's say, a regional specialist, an Arabist, a Saudi Arabia or Egypt specialist, then you would always see how much these organizations were still oriented towards their home countries. And I always read the September 11 attacks as very much connected to the home countries of the jihadists, namely that the message was, if you, the U.S., don't withdraw from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, from Algeria, we will attack you time and again, even in the economic capital of your country, even in the political capital of your country. And that, I think, has changed in the last 12 years. And this can be seen by taking a closer look at the German example, but also other examples. And I think the main reason is Western intervention. We do have an ideological basis for anti-Americanism. We do have an ideological cause for all these attacks, for the internationalization of the jihadist movement in the last 12 years. But at the same time, being under the actual pressure of the Americans in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in other countries worldwide, I think has made the thought of attacking the far enemy, namely the United States, namely Israel, namely the European countries who, at least the allies, the important allies of the U.S., a lot more prominent. So something that many observers saw as something that was unconnected to any local situation in 2001, that was transnational, that was new terrorism, which I thought as premature in 2001, has become a reality in 2013. But because, partly because the serious mistakes of Western counterterrorism, and I would always argue that especially because of the Iraq war, the intervention in Afghanistan, the indirect intervention in Somalia, and so on. All these interventions have made the argumentation that the West is attacking Islam in general a lot more convincing to many young Muslims, and that is a problem in 2013.
Right, right. We might move now to the Islamic Jihad Union. It gets its own chapter in the book, and a very good chapter. Do you want to describe this organization and how they came about?
Yeah, the Islamic Jihad Union is a fascinating organization. I heard about them quite early when I was still in the government, but when the first news about the Zawaland Group emerged in 2007, it was virtually unknown internationally, and it is a splinter group of the far bigger Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. But the Islamic Jihad Union, in contrast to the IMU, had early on developed this thought of attacking the far enemy. The IMU until 2007 was still very much focused on targeting the near enemy. In that case, the regime of Islam Karimov in Uzbekistan. The IJU rather adopted Al-Qaeda thought. It splintered from the IMU in late 2001 or early 2002, and then coexisted with Al-Qaeda, coexisted with the Haqqani network in first in Peshawar and then in North Waziristan in the coming years. And it, at least according to the Zawaland group, Fritz Gelowitz, Adam Yilmaz, the organization was relatively small and it did not have any foreign fighters in its rank when they joined it in 2006. And it had already perpetrated attacks in Uzbekistan quite unsuccessfully in 2004. And then when these four guys from Germany arrived, it had the idea, its leadership had the idea to send them back to Germany in order to perpetrate attacks over there on American targets, but also in order to prompt the Germans to withdraw their troops from Afghanistan in 2007. Well, the Zawaland IV, they returned to Germany, they planned the attacks, and these attacks were thwarted. But suddenly the Islamic Jihad Union, although it was small, it never had more than 100 to 200 fighters, probably suddenly became extremely prominent in the jihadist landscape worldwide. And this is when the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan had to react in order to keep its prominent position in the Uzbek jihadist scene. Although where the Islamic Jihad Union afterwards was fought by the Americans, its leaders were killed by drone strikes, but still the organization seems to exist until today in North Waziristan, but it is a lot weaker than in its heyday in 2007, and I don't know whether we will hear of it again.
Right, right. And these groups, the different groups, when one group splits from another, they don't exactly exist harmoniously. Do they actually fight within each other or against each other?
Well, they sometimes do. I think it is extremely important to see the differences within the jihadist movement. And I think it has been one major mistake of Western policymakers to not pay attention to these differences. Ever since 2001, most of these groups who are jihadist are called either called Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda affiliates. And in the case of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, for example, this is pure nonsense, because the IMU was a competitor of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan already until September 2001. And later on, there have been even violent conflicts between these two groups, because these organizations, of course, they compete for resources, they compete for money coming in, especially from the Gulf countries, they compete for the support of their hosts in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And in a way, there has been a certain convergence between, especially in the tribal areas, simply because all these organizations are now under the pressure of the American drone strikes. But it would have been a lot wiser after 2001 to take a very close look at the differences between these organizations and perhaps try to work on the conflicts, try to foster conflicts between these organizations. And after all, not all of these organizations have totally illegitimate aims. Of course, we cannot agree with an organization that wants to build an Islamic state, let's say, in Libya or Uzbekistan, but it's not that illegitimate to fight against the regime like the one of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya or the regime of Islam Karimov in Uzbekistan. And one of the most problematic results of the Western War on Terror has been that many of these organizations, who were quite nationalist in the beginning, then turned internationalist, adopted Al-Qaeda's global jihad, and then started fighting not only the near enemy, but also the far enemy. And in the case of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, for example, this could have been avoided.
Right. So basically, had they been able to support themselves and concentrate in their initial aim of fighting in their home country, they may not have needed to branch out to international terrorism or targeting other nations.
Yeah, and in a way, after 2001, all these organizations and their personnel was persecuted as Al Qaeda affiliates, and this was simply not the case. And many of the people who were prominent in international jihadism in the last three or four years were not internationalists in the beginning, and we have to ask ourselves whether our countermeasures are at least partly responsible. Why fighting, for example, an organization like the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which has not been an enemy to the West until 2007? It only became an enemy after its ranks were decimated by Western attacks in Pakistan.
Right, right. Well, let's move on to the Zaolan group now. You've already talked Yes. about them a fair bit, but how about just a quick recap of how the participants all joined this group and how they were brought together when they moved overseas, and then what they attempted to do in mm-hmm. Germany?
Well, the Zaolan group is still a little bit of an enigma, because they confessed in court, they talked at length about their time in Pakistan, in Waziristan, and about their plot, but they did not talk about their radicalization process, and I do not think that they told the truth when presenting their early careers here in Germany. There are two parts which constitute this group, but the main center seems to have been the multicultural house in Neu-Ulm, where at least the ringleader, Fritz Gelowitz, and one of his friends in the Sauerland group came from. It seems to me that they were not only radicalized there, that is obvious, but they were recruited and then found their way to the Islamic Jihad Union. Whether or not any recruiter here in Germany or in Turkey was implicated has not been established until today, but I think that in this in their travels there has been a lot more organized activity than they confessed in court in Düsseldorf. But anyhow, they joined the Islamic Jihad Union in 2006, were trained by them, and then asked by the IJU leader, Najmuddin Jalalov, to perpetrate attacks here in Germany. They agreed, although they at least said that they had not planned to perpetrate attacks in Germany. They said that they planned to join the fight in Afghanistan. They went back to Germany and started trying to procure the necessary ingredients for the explosives. And the German authorities had not known that they left the country. They had not known about their stay in Syria, nor about their stay in Pakistan, but the American NSA, the National Security Agency, alerted our Foreign Intelligence Service in October 2006 that there was this small group of guys who had returned and who might plan terrorist attacks in Germany. And in the coming months, between October 2006 and September 2007, German security authorities followed these four guys, and then in September, when they began to assemble the explosives in a small holiday home in the Sauerland region in North Rhine-Westphalia, they were arrested. That was the biggest counterterrorism operation in German history until today, and the trial afterwards was the biggest counterterrorism trial in German history as well.
Right, right. And this is the group that you were saying you were able to interview some of them then, after the fact?
Yes, yes. I am an expert witness in all the terrorism trials here in Germany ever since 2006. And right, when these people confess, when they talk, I have the chance to talk to them as well. And especially the ringleader Fritz Gelowitz, he told the court a lot about his experiences. It's hundreds of pages with their confessions, with their testimonies, which enable us to take a first deeper look at the German jihadist scene, especially in Pakistan.
Right, that's a bit of a dream opportunity for any researcher.
Yes, it is, and that's. But in a way, it's typical for the Germans. In comparison to many of their Arab jihadist colleagues, they seem to be not that deep into jihadist ideology. So it seems to be a little bit easier to bring them to talk in court. Partly because this is rewarded by the German court system. And there have been other cases where German jihadists returning were talking to the prosecutors, talking to the police here in court. So we do have, I mean, quite a decent picture of what is going on, at least in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. However, they tend not to talk a lot about their experiences in Germany in order not not to pose problems to their friends here.
Right, right. Well, look, I've taken up a lot of your time with this interview, and I really appreciate it. But just to our final part of the discussion could be, what would you say is going to happen in Germany in the 5 to 10 years to come in regards to activity as far as radicalization and jihadist activity in Germany?
Well, I think the trend is clear. Organized activity, meaning activity controlled by Al-Qaeda or other big organizations, will or is already reduced. So the big organizations have problems. They have realized that it is very, very hard to plan attacks in Pakistan, send the people back to Germany and perpetrate attacks here. We have had the Sauerland plot, but also the events of the Euro plot, Al-Qaeda members being sent back to Germany in order to perpetrate attacks here. And all these attack plans have been thwarted by the German authorities, but always with the help of our American allies. So this is, as it seems, not the future of jihadist terrorism in Germany. What I think is important, though, is this indigenous trend. We have already seen the German Taliban Mujahideen as the first German jihadist organization, but When its head Manaf Bashir was killed in the tribal areas in April 2010, this organization disintegrated. But we do see right now that there are lots of German jihadists here in the country who want to organize. They already built a small organization which was primarily active in propaganda on the jihadist internet. They called themselves the Nation of Abraham, Millat Ibrahim. It was prohibited, but all these people are still around. For the time being, we do see some activity, jihadists planning terrorist attacks, but without connection to larger organizations. Whether that will be the future of German jihadism is not sure, however, because so many of these guys who have been identified by our security authorities as dangerous have left to the Middle East. Right now, up to 120 German persons are suspected to have joined the fight in Syria. Mm. And the future of German jihadism, I think, depends to a large extent to what will happen in these countries. Because these are Germans, they go to Syria, and if they come back, we do not know what will happen.
Yep. Well, that means that so many groups, even Abu Sayyaf and others, began from people who came home from the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And I know in Australia we have a similar issue where the Australian Federal Police are watching the people who are going to fight in Syria as well from Australia. And hoping, like you, that they don't come back to reform themselves into some form of other organization locally.
Yeah. Well, the thing that has changed is that in recent years we have seen the first effort of German jihadists to build German outfits, propaganda groups, terrorist groups, small cells. That is relatively new. So the whole phenomenon is not something that is dependent on events in Pakistan anymore. We do have an indigenous scene which has grievances concerning their life here in Germany, concerning the foreign policy of the and security policies of the German government, and so on. And the question is how this will mix with the returnees from Syria. And the problem is about Syria is that it might well be that the rebels win the war over there. And it might well be that Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, will play an important role in the political future of the country. If that is the case, I think we will see a new, more German phenomenon, more indigenous phenomenon, growing here in Germany in the coming years. But I think that the time of the big organizations, at least Al-Qaeda, has ended for the time being.
Right. Well, look, Guido, I have to recommend your book to the readers, if for no other reason than the tremendous amount of detail that you've put into what doesn't look like a very long book, but I just couldn't get over every page. You could reread it. I do a lot of work with social network analysis, and I always wanted to plot the relationships as I was reading the book. So it is a tremendous read. It's a great read for, as I said at the beginning,
Thank you.
Everyone who doesn't have a background in the European continent, because it gave me a very different perspective on what's going on both in Europe and in the Middle East. So congratulations on an excellent book.
Thank you. Thank you.
No problem.
That's really nice.
That's all right. You deserve
okay.
it. Thank you very much for the interview too.
Yeah, no, it was a pleasure.